Welcome to Power Play. I'm Todd Vanderhayden. Evan Solomon is off today. Coming up on the show, a health system on the brink. Hospitals in Alberta on the verge of being overrun as the province sets new records. Is the fourth wave of COVID fully out of control? In moments, we bring in the mayor of Calgary, Naheed Nenshi, with his take. Plus, a crackdown in Quebec. Premier François Legault announces big fines to end anti-vax protests in front of hospitals and schools. Is it going to end the blockades? Is it possibly teeing up a constitutional challenge? We dig into it with the president of the Quebec Association of Emergency Physicians joining us coming up. And finally, Erin O'Toole's grip on power.
Erin O'Toole has broken integrity and is not being accountable to the membership that I represent.
Well, the Conservative Party is pushing back against a challenge to O'Toole's leadership today. But can the man who won support as a true blue Conservative stay on as leader after a failed campaign that tacked to the centre? We bring in the Conservative Party president and then former Conservative MP, leadership hopeful Brad Trost, who will join the press gallery. All right, well, this is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The COVID crisis in Alberta reaching a critical point. The healthcare system is starting to buckle because of an influx of patients. The province also reporting its first death of a COVID patient under the age of 20, an 18-year-old woman. Alberta setting new pandemic records as well for our country. 1,040 patients now in hospital, including 230 in intensive care. Hospitals are closing in on that 90% threshold of their surge capacity. The Alberta government has asked for and been given help by the federal government. Public Safety Minister Bill Blair saying Ottawa will approve specific resources and requests quickly. But the City Council in Calgary is not waiting, passing a new bylaw on vaccine passports. Is it going to be enough to tame the fourth wave? Let's bring in the mayor of Calgary himself, Naheed Nenshi, who is standing by. Mr. Nenshi, always good to see you here. Let's talk a little bit about what your city council has decided to do here, really take matters into your own hands because of the necessity and the urgency of the situation.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Todd. And yes, that's exactly what we did. You know, we had what was supposed to be our final city council meeting of the term last week. And everyone told me the last month's real easy. As soon as you bang the gavel, just ease into retirement. Well, that's not quite where we are. So I had to call city council back yesterday because, frankly, the Alberta government's mishandling of this situation has gotten beyond the realm of comedy. It's tragic, and we didn't have to be here. Alberta now has more COVID cases than Ontario, Quebec, and British Columbia combined. And frankly, the city council had to step in. So the premier tied himself in knots last week trying to avoid saying the words vaccine passport, which led to an enormous amount of confusion from restaurant owners, people who operate businesses, people who operate recreation facilities, who just said, everyone's yelling at us saying we have to make a choice on whether to do this or not. But the choice if you're a restaurant is either adopt the vaccine passport or close and be open for takeout and patio only. That's not much of a choice. And so what City Council did yesterday was, number one, we passed a bylaw implementing a mandatory vaccine passport for businesses like restaurants, nightclubs, bars, fitness facilities, casinos, and so on. And number two, we've also started to do our own vaccination outreach. Here in Alberta, cities don't have any public health requirements, unlike in Ontario. It's a provincial responsibility. But we're not waiting. There were two vehicles in the entire province of Alberta doing vaccine outreach. So we now have five vehicles on the streets of Calgary trying to get targeted to people in their 20s, to people in less vaccinated geographic areas. But the biggest thing is I'm now reaching out to all Calgarians saying we get through crises like floods here in the city together. And so people have been asking me that most Canadian of questions, how can I help? And you can help. And if you can hear me, you can help. And you can help by convincing people to get vaccinated. One-on-one conversations are what do it. Encourage them to talk to their pharmacist or their doctor if they have questions. Tell them about your vaccine experience and how it went for you and the hope you felt. Drive them to their appointment. Hold their hand. Do whatever it takes to help us get those numbers up.
Naheed, what are you looking for from the provincial government at this point? I mean, you have seen it all, you know, and you've watched this crisis unfold in real time. Realistically.
Clarity, humility, and a real understanding of the crisis we face. There are some specific things. Obviously, they should be accepting the federal government's help and giving up their pride. They've left so much money on the table because they don't want to give the federal government a win. They need to be supporting small businesses with cash to help them hire people at the door to check the vaccines, to help them with the costs of implementing this. And they need to support our healthcare workers. I don't often praise Premier Legault, but we have a law in Alberta that prevents protesters from blocking critical infrastructure. It's time to take a firm stand so healthcare workers can get to work and can understand that the vast majority of us support them.
This bylaw in Calgary that you've brought in, how long will it be in effect for?
It'll stay in effect as long as the premier, it's the province's, oh gosh, it's such a terrible name, restrictions exemptions program, because they don't want to say passport, will be in place. But the future city council that will be elected in 3 weeks may choose to extend it if we can't get out of this fourth wave.
Naheed Nenshi, the mayor of Calgary, thank you for taking the time as always. Appreciate you coming on the program today.
Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.
All right, so that is the latest in Alberta. Let's head east to Quebec, where Premier François Legault did move today to block anti-vaccine protests outside of hospitals and schools. This new proposed law could see protesters hit with thousands of dollars in fines if they stage demonstrations at those locations. The Quebec government today basically saying enough is enough.
It's never easy to say you cannot manifest, you cannot go on the street. It's not something that you can do every day. So you have to be careful. We want to make sure that people will not win trying to say that the law is unacceptable, that we cannot enforce it.
We should point out the Quebec government has a lot of support from politicians from other parties to move forward with this proposed law. Let's get some reaction, though, from a doctor who works on the front lines in Montreal, where we have seen some of these protests. Dr. Judy Morris, the president of the Quebec Association of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Morris, thanks for taking some time for us today.
You're welcome. Good evening.
Your reaction to this proposed law?
It's unfortunate that we have to make it that far in order to protect our healthcare personnel. But unfortunately, that's where we are. So any support towards our healthcare personnel, any boost and a little bit of a feeling of safety, feeling of being recognized for the work they're doing is going to be welcome. Unfortunately, well, I'll remind you that there's a nurse that has been physically assaulted in the Sherbrooke region. So when people feel threatened, well, when personnel, patients, feel threatened, I think measures have to be put in place.
And as a leader, of course, within the community, you have heard lots of stories from colleagues who have been on the receiving end of this or feel threatened or just don't feel comfortable, feel intimidated by some of these protests or just the fact that they may, in fact, face them as well should they go into a hospital.
Yeah, it's intimidation at this point. And people are scared, people are uncertain, and frankly, they don't need that. They've been battling, we've all been battling the COVID for the past year and a half. And now what's a little bit ironic is that we're taking care of, the hospitals are taking care of the very same people that are protesting outside the door when they unfortunately get sick and very ill with the disease.
What's also remarkable and a little astonishing as well is that when this all began 18 long months ago, people such as yourself, frontline healthcare workers, nurses, personal support workers were seen as heroes. People were clapping and people were doing all sorts of things. And now here we are where you see the protests and some really ugly reaction as well. How do you sort of frame that as a doctor?
It's really hard to understand. You know, a year ago, people, healthcare personnel were heroes, and now some of them feel like they're public enemy number one when they see those protesters outside the hospitals, outside vaccination clinics. It's really tough, and it's really tough because morale has been really low throughout the healthcare system because of all the other things that are happening, the shortage, the COVID, the stress, the overtime. And this is really not something we need right now.
Dr. Morris, you're the president of the Quebec Association of Emergency Physicians, but I know you have a lot of contact with colleagues in other parts of the country. Throughout this pandemic, Quebec has arguably led the way in terms of trying to push forward with very progressive policies. Perhaps this is part of that now, saying enough is enough. Do you think that other provinces in the country need to look at this clearly and think about maybe if they don't already have some kind of law in place, move toward doing that?
It's up to them to decide, but I know that I see on social media that some of my colleagues outside this province are feeling the same way and want to find again the feeling of being recognized for what they've been doing for the past year and a half, and feeling protected also for all the work they're putting in towards fighting this pandemic.
Dr. Judy Morris joining us from Montreal. I know it's busy. Wonderful to have you on Power Play today.
Thanks a lot.
Will he survive politically or not? That's the question swirling around Conservative leader Erin O'Toole just days after the federal election. O'Toole was elected leader of the party just over a year ago, back in August of 2020. But with only a year at the helm, he's already fending off new attacks on his leadership. Remember, he promised to be Justin Trudeau. He didn't do that. He promised to make inroads in Ontario and Quebec. That didn't really happen either. He's now fighting to hold on to his job, but more than 2,000 people and counting have signed an online petition calling for an early leadership review. The man behind that petition, Bert Chen, is a member of the Conservative Party's National Council. He told Power Play that O'Toole has broken the trust of party members.
During the leadership campaign, more than a year ago, Mr. O'Toole ran as a true blue conservative that the members elected him for. When the campaign started, we saw that that was clearly being reversed. We clearly saw that he had backtracked and flip-flopped on issues such as the carbon tax. And that speaks to integrity. Conservatives just want a leader who has integrity and, two, is held accountable.
In response, the Conservative Party's president, Robert Batherson, issuing a strong statement dismissing that petition and defending Erin O'Toole, saying this, quote, "At no time is an online petition, which is open to be influenced by Liberals or other members of any party, part of that process. Our leader, Erin O'Toole, has already initiated a review of the campaign, and I look forward to the National Council playing an important role in examining what worked and what didn't, so we can be ready when Justin Trudeau calls another election." So, what now for the party? Very happy to have Conservative Party President Robert Batherson joining us live right now. Thanks, Robert. Appreciate this.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I know you're dismissing the online petition. What did you make, though, of Bert Chen's attacks on Erin O'Toole's leadership and his integrity, frankly?
Well, first off, as a volunteer president and on behalf of my other volunteers on National Council from coast to coast to coast, I first want to thank all of our candidates across Canada, their campaign managers, their campaign teams for campaigning in a pandemic election that Justin Trudeau forced on Canadians. And I know there is a lot of hurt. We lost some good MPs on election night. There are also pockets of growth for the party that we've seen here in Atlantic Canada. We've seen the popular vote increase in Ontario and Quebec. And now what we have to do is take a step back, participate in the review that our leader, Erin O'Toole, has initiated, and have a good, frank, thoughtful discussion on what went well and what didn't. But more than anything, as president, I want to thank our conservatives at the grassroots level who've worked so hard in this campaign.
I understand that. But when you see people like Bert Chen coming out publicly and saying that there was a lack of leadership by Erin O'Toole and the process needs to be triggered now to bring in a new leader to take the party forward, what do you make of that? I mean, that's a very sort of public smackdown.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to work with Mr. Chen and National Council for the better part of 3 years. You know, the unfortunate thing is there's just been a pattern of questionable behavior by Mr. Chen over the last number of years. He resigned from National Council when he didn't get his way on a vote in December of 2019. Several of us worked hard to find a path to bring him back. He attempted to impeach my predecessor as president in June of 2020. And then we both put our names forward for president for National Council in March. National Council chose me, and I attempted to keep Mr. Chen involved on National Council. I suggested he would make an excellent committee chair. He never chaired a committee in the previous council. He declined that. He went on a leave of absence. I asked him to come back. I encouraged him to come back. He came back. And so I can't explain why Mr. Chen, before even all the votes were cast, or counted rather, decided that the smart thing to do for an office holder of this party was to launch an online petition attacking the leader.
So bigger.
And explain. Mr. Chen and I had a conversation last night. You know, he never informed me or any of his colleagues that he was going to launch this petition. So we're all kind of scratching our head as to what is Mr. Chen's agenda in leading this charge and putting this petition out there.
I know you're not scratching your head, though, over the fact that the party lost what Erin O'Toole had said was a winnable election, and now there is bigger picture. You know, this whole notion that Erin O'Toole moved the party to the center. You know, he had promised to repeal the Liberals' carbon tax when he had the carbon tax, in his party platform. So he didn't do that. And there were a number of other things in which he tacked to the center as well that have left some people in your party, not all, but some, disgruntled.
Well, that's why, having been involved in the conservative movement for the better part of 30 years, one of the things I've learned with experience is in a movement and a party with hundreds of thousands of people, we have hundreds of thousands of opinions. And so the important thing is to take a step back and to listen. And to listen to concerns from grassroots members, to ask the tough questions. And I think that's a valid way to go about it, but we do it through conversation, engagement, respect, and professionalism. We don't do it through a hot-headed petition put out there while votes are still being counted.
It's going to be an interesting couple of months for your party. In the meantime, I thank you for taking some time to come on the show today, Robert.
Anytime.
Robert Batherson, president of the Conservative Party of Canada. All right, we're going to take you to Vancouver now, where the Premier of British Columbia, John Horgan, is speaking after meeting with Canada's premiers.
And the premiers agreed there's urgent, pressing need to act on long-term, sustainable health care funding. We want to do that, as we've been saying for many, many years now, through stable, predictable increases in the Canada Health Transfer. For too long, the federal government has been diminishing their contribution to public health care, and we believe that diminishment has to stop, and we need to get back to a better relationship where at least 35% of public health funding comes from Ottawa. Canadians, of course, expect us all to work together. They expect the premiers to be at the table working in the interests of our respective jurisdictions, but we need a federal partner to do that. We call on the Prime Minister today to hold a First Minister's meeting at an early opportunity, preferably before the next throne speech, but certainly before the end of the year. And on behalf of all British Columbians, earlier in the week I spoke with the Prime Minister and offered my congratulations on his re-election and his government's ability to move forward. I also spoke with Opposition Leader Erin O'Toole and NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, and congratulated them on running campaigns to make sure that all voices are represented in the House of Commons. I did ask the Prime Minister to ensure that we focus on those shared issues that we have been determined to work on collectively, whether it be ensuring that we have affordable, quality childcare, whether we continue to have funding for housing and other initiatives that will keep people safe and in something resembling what they want to be at rather than in encampments. These are issues that both of he and I share, and I'm confident that we will work on those together. We need to continue to build our infrastructure to move our people and to move our goods. And that, of course, includes expanding the SkyTrain from Surrey to Langley. The Prime Minister and I do have a strong working relationship, and I'm looking forward to the next number of months and years on our shared priorities. And that includes making sure that BC's interests within the Canadian Confederation are represented internationally as well. And we did speak, and I've spoken with the Ambassador to the United States about our concern about protectionist measures in the U.S. that would have a negative impact on our tourism sector by restricting citizens' abilities to come to British Columbia to enjoy our spectacular coasts and our opportunities for tourism, and I know the Prime Minister shares that as well.
Lastly, right. I want to say that our shared Premier John Horgan, he is the chair of the Council of the Federation nowadays, of course. The Council of the Federation brings together all the premiers in our country. Let's dig into the provincial priorities for this new minority government that will be run by Justin Trudeau. We'll go from BC to the other side of the country and bring in the Premier of New Brunswick, Blaine Higgs, who is standing by today. Premier, always good to see you, and thanks for taking some time to come on Power Play today.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be here.
So healthcare, top of mind, obviously. This reelected government, though, hasn't promised to meet the demands here, this ask of $28 billion. I'm just curious, you know, what the path forward is here.
Well, I think as Premier Horgan has laid out, certainly our discussion tonight stayed true to our requests that we've all had for some time now, that we have to address a sustainable healthcare model. I think in the election there was a lot of money that was promised in many different forms, and in many different forms that would relate to healthcare in some way. So what we're looking at, and I think there's a bridge here, is to say, you know, there's many areas that we can certainly agree on that need to be funding within the healthcare, but let's make it part of a sustainable healthcare package that we can administer provincially and have responsibilities to raise the bar. So I'm hopeful, and the federal government has a new mandate, and we need to pick up where we left off, and so there's some advantages in that regard, that this is not a new position we're taking. It's a real one. It's one that the Prime Minister had indicated previously that he wanted to meet with us and have a full forum on health reform or health care within the country, I should say. So that's the goal, and I'm hopeful he'll accept the meeting invitation.
In layman's terms, why do the provinces need such an influx of cash?
Well, healthcare, and certainly in an aging demographic, which we could look in the Maritimes, and we're an example, but we're not unique in that regard. The costs of healthcare are skyrocketing. The challenges in the healthcare system across the country have been only heightened because of the pandemic. So it's in the funding formula has gotten skewed over the years. It started as a 50-50 formula. It's now 20-80, so 20 federal and 80 provincial. So we need a reckoning here that gets us on a sustainable path forward. So we can't ignore the obvious in this regard. We can't keep doing things that aren't necessary in the name of some new idea. We have new challenges. Mental health would be something that's increased dramatically in over the years that we have to focus on now. So I think there's a reality check on what's required in order to raise the bar on existing issues but meet the challenges of new issues.
Are you open to the federal government increasing funding, Premier Bliggs, but with some strings attached?
Well, it's always important to say, understand what the strings are. Hmm. You know, if it's some new program that we don't need and we have other areas of a higher priority, I think it's saying, well, let's get a reality check here, what's important to an individual province or the country as a whole. So without understanding the strings, I think it's hard to say one way or the other. We prefer, as we have accountability, is to say what's our requirements in our province, what's our requirements nationally to meet the Canada Health Act, and to ensure we have consistency of healthcare delivery across the country. And I guess so. Let's understand how we achieve better results for people, and that should be the goal of the federal government. Should be the goal of every premier. But to say strings, well, you got to define just what does a string look like.
Yeah, one other thing I'm curious about, and I'm happy to get you on the program today. A lot of discussion going on right across the country, New Brunswick, in all the provinces about vaccine passports. And just, the question of interoperability, that we have a bit of a patchwork here, different standards for different provinces. Do you think we should have a national standard when it comes to a vaccine passport to make things a whole lot simpler and easier?
Yes, I do. And that was a topic as well today in relation to, we're all kind of doing our own thing as we adopt a registration for vaccines. And we do need a national standard. And that was something I believe, the Prime Minister had committed to prior to the election, and I'm sure will still be an important item. But we need to do that sooner than later because we're all working on something in our own world. And it needs to have an interface capability with a national capability and interface.
Blaine Higgs is the Premier of New Brunswick, joining us today live from Fredericton on the program. Good to see you. Thank you for this.
You're very welcome.
Okay, stay with us. A campaign review and a call for Erin O'Toole to be pushed out as leader of the Conservatives. How does the party move on from this week's punishing loss? And what does the rise of the People's Party of Canada mean for the Conservatives' big picture? Brad Tross joins the press gallery. That's coming up next. Now, welcome back. The Conservative Party of Canada dealing with a rough political hangover this week. They lost the election Monday. Now tough questions over what went wrong and where does the buck stop? Leader Erin O'Toole has already tabled a review of the campaign, while one National Conservative Council member has launched an online petition calling for O'Toole to step down as leader. That change.org petition has more than 2,000 signatures and counting. There's no way to know if they're all actually Conservatives, of course, but is it time for a new leader? And there's also the rise of the People's Party of Canada and the effect they had on Monday night. What should other parties make of their winning 800,000 votes in their second election campaign? Let's bring in the press gallery. Robert Benzie is the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Laura Stone is with the Queen's Park Bureau for the Globe and Mail. And we also have former Conservative MP Brad Trost and 2017 Conservative leadership candidate. Good to see all three of you. Maybe I can start with you, Brad, and your read on this. Is it time for Erin O'Toole to go?
Well, he needs to answer two questions. First of all, what went wrong and why is he the person to fix it? If he can't answer those two questions clearly and distinctly, then the answer is yes. If he can't answer those, then he can probably hang in there. But right now, that's a very, very open question.
Laura, what do you think about Erin O'Toole and his future now as pressure is mounting for him to do the right thing for the party, as some think, and step aside?
Well, you know, I think the reviews are mixed right now. I think you do have some within the caucus who are extremely upset and dismayed by the results. And you saw the petition from the national councillor on the Conservative Party yesterday calling for an early leadership review, saying that Mr. O'Toole betrayed Conservative principles and suggesting that he moved too far to the center and forgot about the grassroots, forgot who he was. But then you have others coming out in support, not specifically about Mr. O'Toole's leadership, although we are hearing that as well, but just calling for party unity and saying kind of this open infighting in the public, in the media, does nothing to help their cause and, in fact, only helps the Liberals. And it's something that the Conservatives have gone through time and time again. So it does kind of seem like there's a lot of people biding their time right now, not quite sure what to think, not quite sure exactly what went wrong, if Mr. O'Toole was too centrist or if he had some missteps in the platform, if he was portrayed as too right-wing by the Liberals. I don't think anyone really has a clear sense yet. And so that's why I think you're sort of seeing this drip, drip, drip of people coming out and criticizing, but a bit more cloaked than out in the open so far.
Yeah, cloaked, maybe cloaking some daggers as well. Robert, what do you think? Because, you know, it has only been two and a half days, right?
Yeah, Todd, I've been talking to Conservatives across the country just to get along with my colleagues at the Star's Ottawa Bureau, trying to figure out what the lay of the land is with this party. And one thing that is distilled in my thinking through these conversations is, unlike 2019 with Andrew Scheer, Erin O'Toole has indicated very strongly that he is not going anywhere. His team around him is much more defiant against these dissenters, at least privately, and perhaps they will soon be publicly, than Mr. Scheer's supporters were after the 2019 election. I think Mr. Scheer, remember, resigned of his own volition, but he felt he just didn't have the heart for the fight. He didn't want to do this debilitating, review process. Mr. O'Toole, in contrast, seems to relish this fight and seems to be ready to take it on. And his team seems more organized than Mr. Scheer's team did after 2019. So I think if he wants to stay, it's going to be very hard to push him out. That's not going to say that there aren't efforts to do this, but I think that he's arguing from a position of strength in terms of his stance. He has control of the party's finances. He has control of most of the party. Certainly the party president is in his corner. Maybe, Mr. Chen, one councillor who is seen as a bit of a malcontent, is unhappy. And frankly, Todd, 2,000 signatures on a change.org petition that's gotten as much publicity on your show and on other shows, that's not really that great. I would have thought they would have had more by now.
Valid points. Let's go back to Saskatoon and bring Brad back into the conversation. So here's where things get interesting, and I know you've been following very closely. Erin O'Toole comes out and he says, high risk, high reward. I'm going to tack to the center. I'm going to make inroads in Quebec and Ontario. I'm going to be a kinder, more gentle type of Conservative leader. It obviously didn't work for a number of different reasons here. Was that a mistake in your mind?
Well, I think their mistake was they didn't really have a clear vision. They kept saying they're going to tack to the center, and then they just sort of left it at that. They modified some of their positions. But what really was Erin O'Toole's vision? At the convention in March, he laid out five basic points that he was going to run on. Those points seem to have gotten lost. I'm still not 100% sure what is Erin O'Toole's vision other than he wants a more progressive Conservative Party. That's a generalization, but a lot of voters are not ideological. They want something that relates to them. And I think that's the question Erin has to answer. Why didn't he relate to voters? He didn't relate to voters, particularly in bigger cities, and that's specifically where he promised to make gains. And that's going to be his problem until he can answer that question.
Brad, just staying with you for a moment about the, you know, the flip-flop on the carbon tax. We're going to repeal it. Actually, no, it's part of our platform. How much damage did that do?
Well, talking to members of the caucus about it when it happened, by and large, there was a lot of unhappiness with his decision. They kept unified. They kept behind him. But he now has to explain why they should eat a policy that a lot of them really weren't very pleased with. And a lot of the membership wasn't pleased with. I was running for a Conservative nomination at the time when the flip-flop happened. A lot of party members were very angry. So Erin's got a problem with some of his issues, and he's taken stands that he doesn't have a mandate for the membership from. And that's going to be problematic in a party like the Conservatives, which isn't all about power. It's a mixture of the NDP liberal approaches, partially about principle and partially about power.
All right, we're going to hit the pause button on the press gallery just for a moment because we're going to go live to Alberta. Big story playing out, of course, today amid this fourth wave. We're getting an update from COVID. We're going to listen to that for a few minutes. Dr. Dina Hinshaw is up in Edmonton.
60 new cases and completed about 18,000 tests. Our positivity rate was about 9.4%. Currently, 1,058 people are being treated for COVID-19 in hospital, including 226 in the ICU. 100% of new ICU admissions were in Albertans who did not have any vaccine protection. Sadly, I must announce that 17 new deaths were reported to Alberta Health in the last 24 hours. My condolences go out to the loved ones of these individuals and to all who have lost a family member or friend to any cause during this pandemic. As with the deaths reported earlier this week, while a small number of these individuals were double vaccinated with pre-existing health conditions, most were not vaccinated at all. Vaccines are safe, effective, and they save lives. It's important for all of us to do our part to protect those who are vulnerable. I know that many parents are eager to have their children under 12 vaccinated, and as I said on Tuesday, we are watching the evidence closely. While we have seen an increase in young people diagnosed with COVID during this wave, to date we have not seen an increase in the proportion of children who are experiencing severe outcomes from COVID. This is not to minimize the fact that young people still face some risk, but it is another reminder that by lowering transmission in all ages, and by those who are eligible getting vaccinated, we can help protect those who aren't yet old enough to access vaccine. Every Albertan turning 12 this year or older has been eligible to be vaccinated for about 4 months now, and I cannot stress enough the importance of making this choice to protect you, those around you, and our healthcare system. Vaccines remain one of our most powerful tools in the fight against COVID-19. That's why today I would like to highlight once again some of our key data. Albertans who have not been fully vaccinated are about 15 times more likely than unvaccinated Albertans. Albertans who have not been fully vaccinated are about 15 times more likely than those with vaccine protection to end up in the hospital from COVID-19. They are about 40 times more likely to be admitted to the ICU. About 77% of Albertans in hospital with COVID are not fully vaccinated, and 92% of those in the ICU right now have not had both shots. We have heard persistent questions and rumors on social media that vaccines are not working against the Delta variant, but this is categorically untrue. In Alberta, COVID-19 vaccines have proven to be 85% effective against infection with the Delta variant after two doses. COVID-19 vaccines are even more highly effective at preventing severe disease and death, including against the highly contagious Delta variant. The bottom line is that two doses of vaccine will protect most people from getting sick, having to go to the hospital, or dying if they catch the virus. However, no vaccine is 100% effective. A very small percentage of fully vaccinated people could still get COVID if they're exposed to the disease. These are called vaccine breakthrough cases, and although the risk of severe illness is much less in these cases, it is important to remember that some people have conditions that mean their body cannot fully respond to doses of vaccine. That's why preventing these breakthrough cases requires the rest of us to participate in forming a protective shield around them and may necessitate a booster for some individuals, which is why we expanded criteria for immunocompromised eligibility earlier this week. Please, if you are not yet fully vaccinated, do so as soon as possible. I also encourage you to help others who may need help finding reputable sources of information on COVID vaccines, or those who need help making or getting to vaccination appointments. I also know there have been many questions about immune response from prior infection. Some people are wondering if they need a vaccine if they've already had COVID-19, and whether having recovered from infection should make them exempt for the restrictions exemption program. At this time, everyone needs proof of vaccine or a recent negative result on a privately purchased test or a medical exemption in order to enter businesses in the restrictions exemption program. The bottom line is that my advice for those who have had COVID-19 remains the same. It is still best for everyone to be fully vaccinated with two doses to obtain the greatest possible protection from infection. It's also important to remember right now that with our current high levels of transmission, there is still some risk that anyone, whether or not they have recovered from a previous COVID-19 infection or have received immunization, could possibly be reinfected and potentially transmit COVID-19 to others who may be vulnerable to severe outcomes. That's why masking in indoor public places and staying at home if feeling ill is mandatory for everyone in all areas of the province. And I encourage getting tested if you are showing COVID-19 symptoms. Finally, on the topic of post-infection immunity, I want to speak about an event that is being reported in the news. While I have not received confirmation that this event took place, reports began circulating yesterday of an event where several people are said to have gathered in a deliberate attempt to acquire COVID-19 in order to develop post-infection immunity. It is being reported that several of these individuals ended up in hospital and in already crowded Edmonton ICUs. Again, I cannot confirm that these reports are accurate, but whether or not this specific report is verified, what is important to know is that anyone contemplating this kind of activity should know that this consequence, severe illness, and transmitting to others who may become severely ill or even die, is an absolutely likely outcome. Hosting or attending an event like this in the current time of crisis is irresponsible and dangerous. It doesn't just put you at risk, but those around you, including people who may need healthcare for other reasons than COVID, but have no critical care capacity available for them when they need it. If anyone wants to get protection from infection, vaccines are free, highly effective, and easily available. The safest and best way to reach herd immunity for Albertans is to be vaccinated, plain and simple. We need each other more than ever right now, and making choices to keep family, friends, and communities safe from the impacts of COVID-19 is life and death work that requires all of us. Thank you, and I'll now invite my colleague, Dr. Yu, to update you on our healthcare system.
Good afternoon. Before I begin, I want to take a minute to express my deep condolences to those who have lost a loved one during this exhausting pandemic. We've seen a number of deaths due to COVID-19 increase significantly during this fourth wave, a sad reminder to all of us that this virus is deadly, particularly to those who are unimmunized. Every day we see the numbers. There are people behind the numbers. They are spouses and partners, grandparents, uncles and aunts, sons and daughters. They are people's best friends and loved ones. The other people that I think of regularly are those Albertans who have been impacted by our decision to postpone surgeries. Having your surgery delayed can be extremely traumatizing, particularly if you've been waiting a long time, and especially if your surgery is potentially life-changing. Delaying surgeries is not something that we ever want to do. But unfortunately, right now, it is necessary to reduce the pressure on our ICUs. We are deeply sorry to all Albertans who have been impacted by this. I wish that we were not in this position, and my heart goes out to all of you. Our hospitals, and in particularly our intensive care units, continue to experience unprecedented patient demand. As of early afternoon, there are 310 Albertans in ICU, of which 226 patients have COVID-19. We have never, ever had that number of total patients in ICU before, never with the prior waves, and never in the history of this province. And each day, we see a new high. Yesterday alone, we had 22 Albertans who were admitted to our ICUs with COVID. The day before, we had 23. And over the past 5 days, the average number of COVID ICU admissions have been more than 23 per day. It's tragic that we are only able to keep pace with these sort of numbers because, in part, some of our ICU patients have passed away. And this reality has a deep and lasting impact on our ICU teams. With that in mind, I should also note that in the past 2 days, our teams have managed to move 18 patients out of ICU, which means that these patients no longer need that critical level of care and are hopefully on the long road to recovery. We are facing a fragile balance. On some days, we are seeing more ICU patients than admitted, than new ICU beds being created. We are transferring more patients out of zones to zones where there is additional critical care capacity. And every day, our teams are focused on adding more critical care capacity. Our incredible physicians and staff continue to do amazing things in order to allow us to increase capacity and to meet the demands and needs of our patients. As of noon today, we have 350 ICU beds across the province, which keeps our ICU capacity at 89%. We have added 177 ICU surge spaces, which means that we have more than doubled our baseline of ICU beds. And without those additional beds, our capacity would be at 179%. Creating capacity is not a simple task, and the beds we have added are not standard ICU beds. In fact, nothing is really standard about the situation right now, including staff ratios and some of the patient care we are providing outside of our ICUs. But this is the reality of our current situation. We have to do things differently to ensure that we can care for all patients. However, I want to reassure people that safety remains at the forefront of all our decisions. My commitment to you is that we will continue to do everything possible to care for Albertans, and that commitment will never waver. I'm pleased to see that so many Albertans are getting immunized against COVID-19 in the past week. I'd like to thank all of you who have taken this important life-saving step, and I strongly encourage and urge all of you who have not been immunized to get immunized as quickly as possible. Please, if you have any questions or concerns about the vaccine or its effectiveness or how safe it is, please reach out to a healthcare professional or call 811 or visit the AHS website. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's important to get the facts. Sadly, we're definitely seeing an increase in cases in children ages between 10 and 19 years of age. It is clear that the Delta variant is much more virulent than previous variants of concern, and that it has impacted younger people at higher rates. So to make it easier for eligible children and teenagers to get immunized, we are supporting schools to provide immunizations at temporary in-school clinics. This is open to eligible students in grades 7 to 12, as well as teachers and staff.
All right, so clinics. We're following the very latest from Edmonton. 1,660 new cases of COVID in Alberta. Let that sink in as the province deals with the worst situation it has faced so far during this pandemic. Medical staff with the Canadian military will now be brought in to help as needed. Air support as well from the military to possibly transfer very serious cases out of Alberta. We're going to continue to follow what's going on in the province as it deals with a punishing fourth wave right here on CTV News Channel. Let's get back to our press gallery, though, and one of the biggest political takeaways for the Conservative Party, what happens after you lose an election and how much of that defeat lays at the feet of Erin O'Toole as leader. There are already rumblings by his critics of the party. They feel needs to have a new leader. At the same time, the People's Party of Canada pulled away support from O'Toole, about 800,000 votes or so from Maxime Bernier, back to Robert Benzie, Laura Stone and Brad Trost, who are all standing by here. Appreciate you as we were covering that story out of Alberta. Let's go back to you, Laura, and your read on what the best case scenario is here for Erin O'Toole amid this fiasco, losing the election and really actually less seats than Andrew Scheer in 2019.
Well, look, I mean, he clearly needs to get his caucus on side, and I think that's why he's trying to bide time. And we've heard that his team is reaching out to members to ask for them to openly support him. And now we're starting to see tweets from Conservative MPs and candidates. And we saw former Premier Mike Harris, for instance, write an op-ed in the Toronto Sun. So it's full court press now from his team to rally around the leader. But I think what's going to happen is, you know, Mr. O'Toole needs to maintain control of this party and look like he is still at the helm. So he's obviously going to start offering positions to his caucus members to try to win them over. He's going to be, you know, building up his senior team. And we know that his team has talked about using the Reform Act, which is basically a mechanism that could launch a review of his leadership if enough of caucus members agree to it. So I think that they're hoping that that won't happen, and they're trying to buy themselves time here and work with caucus in order to make them happy and to ensure that he can stay on until the next election. And I think also try to convince their members that a leadership race right now would not be good for the party. They've just done this. You know, it's going to set a precedent of every couple of years. If the leader doesn't live up to expectations or doesn't win, they're going to rip out the page and start afresh. And I think that they'll be making that argument very strongly to caucus and to their members that now is not the time.
Yeah, and Rob, there have always been questions around Erin O'Toole in terms of whether he's a strong leader or strong enough leader. Does he have the right stuff, so to speak? Or is he perhaps, you know, challenged when it comes to connecting with voters that he can be a future prime minister here? Not a lot of great options for the party amid this defeat. And yet, as Laura's saying, you know, maybe there's a sort of time-buying strategy going on for Erin O'Toole. You know, if I can sort of last through the next couple of months here through the worst of it, maybe I survive.
Yeah, I mean, he can rag the puck for a little while. He controls a lot of levers of power in the party. Obviously, there's going to be malcontents, but it's not like the whole country was talking about how he was storming to victory and he somehow blundered and lost the election. Remember, when this election was called by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals, it was because Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals were convinced they were going to win a majority. And the pundit class across the country was saying that, you know, majority was within reach as well. And I think a lot of I'll be guilty as charged as part of that, I guess. But but thanks to a pretty disciplined campaign by Mr. O'Toole, they did better than I think some people thought they were going to do. And Mr. O'Toole won 119 seats. Well, you know what? The great conservative, Stephen Harper, won 99 seats in 2015. So
true.
He did better than Stephen Harper, and he did better in the popular vote than Stephen Harper's last round. The only times Justin Trudeau ever won a majority was against Stephen Harper. So I don't really quite understand how I see, you know, some of the Harper folks, you know, loyalists are whispering in our ears and others' ears saying, you know, we just need another Stephen Harper. Well, I don't know, maybe not. So,
yeah, and
I mean, look, you know, they have their challenges, and I understand their disappointment. But if I were a Mr. O'Toole, I would just stare down his dissenters.
Yeah, they did win the popular popular vote again as well, as Brad knows. And Brad, back to you, the People's Party of Canada. I'm curious to get your read on the effect. Is this going to become now a problem for either Erin O'Toole or future leaders of the Conservative Party, whoever they may be, in elections ahead?
If they don't deal with it, it will be. I think in this election, it's arguable they hurt the Conservatives. How much? That's a good question. No one knows. But there is another option out there for right-wing voting, right-of-center voting Canadians. And if you have competition for what should be your natural share of the market, that's a problem. So if they just wish Bernier to go away, if they wish the People's Party to go away, maybe they'll get lucky, but that's not a strategy. So I think if they're going to be serious and answer their questions as to what went wrong in the election, the People's Party isn't the only problem they have to solve, but they have to actually have an answer on how to deal with them. And that's one of the things I, as a conservative, am waiting to hear from party headquarters and the O'Toole team.
Just before we go, Brad, I just want to ask you about the leadership question. Do you think that Erin O'Toole has the right stuff to be a leader? Is he a strong enough leader, or were you always a bit concerned about him?
Well, I last leadership race, I endorsed Leslyn Lewis and Derek Sloan. I put the same question to some members of the caucus today about what they thought they were doing. One of the MPs who's supporting O'Toole figures caucus is about 60% opposed to Erin, 40% in favor. So I think this is very much a jump ball question, and I think it depends a lot on how Erin deals with the situation over the next few weeks. If he can't answer the questions we put forward earlier in this, he's gone. He needs to win over supportive MPs who currently aren't supporting him. So if he can't do that, then he doesn't have the right stuff.
Brad Trost joining us from Saskatoon, along with Laura Stone from the Globe and Mail and Rob Benzie from, of course, the Toronto Star. Hey, it's great to see all three of you. Good conversation, and appreciate the three of you following the puck there as we covered what was going on, the horrible situation in Alberta. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
No problem.
All right, that is your Power Play Day in Politics. I'm Todd Vanderhaeden. Great to have you with us, and thanks for watching. I'll be back here again tomorrow. Until then, have a great rest of your Thursday.